Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. Hey guys, are you a fan of gemstones? Do you like goddesses? Do you know about the divine feminine? Well, we're going to talk about all of that and more in today's show with Nicholas Pearson as we discuss his latest book, and that's Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine. So this is going to be a great show. I can feel it in my bones already. And if you want to know about crystals, this is the guy to talk to. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through the blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back. But you know, I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners. Intuitive since birth, I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and of the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, The Men and Money Book, and Masterful Choices, The Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the absolute fullest. Now, my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. My guest today, Nicholas Pearson, has been immersed in all aspects of the mineral kingdom for more than 20 years. He began teaching crystal workshops in high school, later studying mineral science at Stetson University while pursuing a degree in music. He worked for several years at the Gillespie Museum, home to the largest mineral collection in the southern United States. He's a certified teacher and practitioner of Reiki, and he teaches crystal and Reiki classes throughout the United States. He's based in the Orlando, Florida area, and you can check him out at his website, and that is theluminouspearl.com. Again, theluminouspearl.com. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Monique. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Absolutely love the book. Folks, this is like a tome. It's like an encyclopedia. It's about a little bit over 6,470 pages, full of all information. Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine. He talks about the different crystals. He talks about the different goddesses. He gives you an in-depth history, but in a very wonderfully kind and intriguing way so that you can retain the information that you read. And if it speaks to you, you'll feel it just vibrating throughout your system. So, Nicholas, at a very young age, how did you answer the call of crystals and the divine feminine?
You know, my love affair with the mineral kingdom began probably about the time I could walk. Just instinctively, I was that kid who picked up rocks everywhere I went. It didn't matter if it was a state park, the beach, my grandparents' neighbors, gravel driveway. I had this resonance with the kingdom of stone. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather, in his infinite wisdom, must have observed this and saw the pattern. And so he gave me my very first piece of quartz.
Oh, wow.
It's still in my beloved collection today. We've snuck it into a couple pictures and a couple of the books, including mm-hmm. for my next book, which will be out maybe next year. And I never looked back. Suddenly, suddenly stone was transformed. It was transparent. It was luminous. There were these really regular faces and angles that somehow felt very predictable and comfortable to me. There was something mm-hmm. really familiar about it. And that started me to want to know everything there was to know about rocks and minerals, where a lot of other families went to church on weekends. My mm-hmm. dad and I went to the library, so I got the luxury of studying just about anything I wanted to. And it might be mineral science one week, it might be metaphysics the next, and my interest has always been in weaving those two things together.
Well, it's wonderful that you had a family that was so supportive. I mean, you said that your grandfather had given you your first stone, if you will. And in the book, you have he has beautiful photographs throughout the books of different stones, and it's absolutely gorgeous. But in the book, he has a picture of a blue sapphire that Granddad had. So perhaps, you know, you were channeling Granddad's energy, although he was still on Earth with you, regarding the rocks, regarding the gemstones?
Yeah, you know, that particular ring has gone through a few generations. It belonged to my great-grandfather, then to my grandfather. My dad had it for a bit, and you know, now it's in my jewelry box. My great-grandfather must have had very tiny fingers, because it doesn't really fit on me today. But it's a beloved treasure in my toolbox.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely gorgeous, and I can understand, you know, why you were drawn to that. Now, you also talk about the different goddesses and, you know, what they bring to the table so that we could further understand them. When you were playing with the stones as a child and investigating them as a child, how did you jump that chasm from stones to incorporating goddess energy?
You know, that was a really gradual shift that took place. I probably in my early teens, maybe just before that, in my adolescence, I started to explore different flavors of spirituality, if you will. I wanted to sample everything on the buffet of religion and spirituality. My mm-hmm. dad was raised Catholic, and that meant I wasn't raised a whole lot of anything, so I had a lot of freedom there, within reason, of course. Mm-hmm. I really felt strangely at home with the idea of the divine feminine, divine masculine coexisting, cohabitating at times, sometimes not. And in my mid-teens, I really kind of fell headlong into the world of ritual magic and mythology and world religion. And I really loved the earth-based religions, like in neo-pagan traditions and Wicca and witchcraft. And this idea of a supernal mother, a great goddess that birthed the cosmos, just felt perfect to me. I have this wonderful tribe of women that has been, an ongoing influence in my life. My mom, my grandmother, my aunts, my cousins, as well as so many wonderful teachers and mentors that, you know, it made perfect sense to have divinity expressed as both male and female. And in those early days, because I never really had a strong relationship with God the Father, God mm-hmm. as Mother was right at home. And if we look at depictions of her and roles that she has played throughout the world, the most universal of them all is Mother Earth, the goddess as our planet, as nature incarnate. And when we hold pieces of the mineral kingdom, when we hold rock and stone, gem, sand, dust, earth, we're holding part and parcel of her body. Every time we hold our favorite crystal or gemstone, that is a cell in the great body of the Earth Mother. And so it really becomes natural to want to explore one when we're already in tune with the other.
Okay. Excuse me. So personal question for you. Do you wear gemstones or do you just have them in your area, in your throughout your home or office?
All of the above. I wear or at least carry rocks with me every day of my life.
Okay. Because folks, she has some spells toward the back of the book and different remedies, if you will, using stones and a few elixirs. And it's quite fascinating. So if you are at all in tune to working with these energies, this book that Nicholas has written is the book for you, because it's an encyclopedia. You'll have it on your shelf and pull it out often to help you as you're working through your life here as a spirit living a human existence. Now, Nicholas, when it comes to picking a stone, do we just go and pick out what, you know, our eye catches, or do we say, okay, that rock feels good, it looks good, you pick it up, and then perhaps muscle test it, kinesiology, to see if it works for you.
I think we all process information on different levels. So for some of us, it's going to be like this instinctive pull. We're just going to be drawn to the stone we need. Other people are going to get that information in a real, like, tactile, kinesthetic sense, and they'll feel the connection when they hold the stone. Others might need to use other systems for validating that, whether it's your applied kinesiology, like with muscle testing, or dowsing with, you know, pendulum or dowsing rods. There's so many options, and I think it's important to explore several. But ultimately, the thing that always works best for me is kind of shutting off the chatter of the mind and listening to the stone itself. And that's not to say it speaks in clear sentences, although, you know, I've met some rocks that are very eloquent. But there's this idea of energy, of resonance. And if we can tune into that, then we can, you know, feel our way into partnership with the mineral kingdom.
Okay. So basically you're saying just go with the flow. But what about if you're buying online? How do you, you know, you go online and you look at all the beautiful crystals and they look great through your browser. And then, you know, you might purchase it and get it home and you're like, ooh, a little bit different. So what information do you have for folks who are buying online so that they can have more clarity around what they're picking out?
I mean, first and foremost, you know your source. Get to know the vendors. You know, look at reviews if there are any. Make sure that they are those honest sellers with integrity who are willing to answer questions. And then, you know, follow up by asking questions. Make sure that you know whether or not the one pictured is the one you're actually getting, or is it a representation of a large sample set, and yours may look nothing like that. And, you know, above and beyond all the practical considerations, we can tune in intuitively via distance with that picture, just like we can in person. You know, there are so many different methods for doing that. I mean, for me, I just kind of make space by putting my conscious mind in a box on the shelf for a moment to let my more intuitive mind step into that flow. But, you know, ultimately, if we have a good relationship with our crystal sellers that are out there, then we're going to end up with stones that are a wonderful healing tool.
Okay, so we pick our stone, we either buy it, you know, in person or it arrives at home. What do we do next? What's the very next crucial step to claiming the stone and integrating it into our lives?
I mean, for me, once I've got that new tool, I need to start my relationship with it. And the easiest way to do that is by cleansing the stone. Not that I think other people's energy is necessarily harmful or that its journey to get from the earth to me is fraught with danger and it's picked up all these negative vibes. But, you know, plain and simple, those vibes aren't mine. So I want to give the crystal an opportunity to sort of shake them off and shed what doesn't serve it or me so we can start with a nice clean slate. So cleansing can consist of a lot of different methods. You can use sun and water and salt and sacred smoke, and you can use the breath and prayer and visualization and representation of the four elements and sacred sound, and the list goes on and on and on. The good news is that some of those methods work for every crystal, but let's say you have your most favorite piece of kunzite and you just want it to drink up sunlight. Well, even in 30 minutes, a nice deeply saturated piece of kunzite can fade in sunlight. So we have to know a little bit about crystal chemistry and structure because we can do a little bit of damage here. If we take a really delicate crystal and put it on top of our favorite quartz cluster to charge it, we might scratch it. If we take a really hard stone and place it on a slab of selenite, we can scratch the heck out of our selenite. Some are susceptible to water and to salt and so many options. So, you know, generally speaking, I suggest breath, smoke, and sound as pretty universal tools, but you'll find that some crystals will respond really well to other methods also. So just, you know, do your homework and make sure the way that you cleanse is going to support the crystal in a physical sense as well as in a metaphysical sense.
Okay, so in your book you talk about, you know, the magical uses of each stone, the elemental signature, the astrological signature, the goddess archetype, and the formation process of each stone. So you have the stone, you've cleansed it, you know, to the best of your abilities. When you program it, well, first of all, how do you program it? And then when you do program it, do you have to keep in mind what, you know, moonstones are positive for, or can you just program it for whatever you want?
you know, there's a little room for flexibility here. For me, I use the term programming to represent that first co-creative act where we're trying to get the stone on board with whatever our intention might be. So, you know, in the 80s and 90s when the term programming really came about, this was kind of like the idea of installing a program on a computer, but that kind of treats them as inert tools that are at the beck and call of our will. And mm-hmm. I think really they're living beings in their own right. They might not have, you know, life in a biological sense, but in a spiritual sense, they're very much as alive as you and me. So, you know, the idea of programming is extending that invitation. Here is my plan, my goal, my objective. This is what my true will desires. How can we work on this together? And so in that sense, we do need to be mindful of what the stone is here to help us for. I might pick a really wonderful piece of, you know, maybe root beer brown fluorite, and my goal with that fluorite is to help me with, like, organization and grounding the mind. And that fluorite is totally on board because that's what fluorites are all about. But maybe I try to assign that fluorite a job that's just outside of its wheelhouse. That would be like going to a native speaker of Chinese who is monolingual and asking them to read a text in ancient Greek. Mm-hmm. You know, some things can be a little bit incompatible. And I think the crystal does a lot better job of maybe moving outside its comfort zone than we human beings do. But we still have to be mindful that we need the right tool for the right job.
Okay. Folks, we're speaking with Nicholas Pearson. He's the author of Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it everywhere. And he's also written some other books, The Seven Archetypical Stones. He's also written Crystals for Karmic Healing, Crystal Healing for the Heart. A lot of love energy there. And you've also written a book on Reiki. So let's switch gears a moment and talk about you and Reiki and the stones and how it all comes together. Now, you're a Reiki master teacher and you offer Reiki courses?
I do, absolutely.
Okay. And in your Reiki training, you wrote a wonderful, seems like very well-received book. I looked it up on Amazon and was looking at the reviews. What prompted you to come up with this and integrate Reiki into your healing modality with the stones? Because I truly feel that stones are healing.
Yeah, I mean, crystals are definitely very healing. In my personal practice, the two don't really mix very much. If we look at the origins of Reiki and its historical practices, tools like color and sound and chakras and auras and all of these other things didn't really start to get added until maybe the mid to late 80s and after that. You know, in the original teachings, Reiki is this beautiful holistic modality that is complete unto itself and it needs nothing to be grafted on to augment it. It is so profound and it works at such a soul-driven level that oftentimes the simplest techniques are the most effective. And that's deceptive to the conscious mind because we go, well, it really can't be that simple. But with Reiki, it is. And so I do occasionally intermingle the two. There are a couple historic precedents where we see evidence of crystals being integrated into Reiki practice in the very early days. So Usui Mikawa, the founder of Reiki, purportedly would give Leiju, which was what the original attunement looked like in Japan, to clear quartz and clear quartz only. And then these Reiki attuned crystals would be gifted to people who lived too far away to attend a Reiki class or couldn't see a Reiki practitioner for regular treatment because they would emanate that Reiki energy forever and always. And could be used, you know, placed on the body just like we would place hands on the body if we were practicing Reiki. But apart from that, there really isn't any overlap between traditional Reiki and crystal healing. So I don't often mix them in my personal practice just because I really like to maintain the integrity of the system of Reiki.
Okay, and that's fair. So let's switch gears a little bit from Reiki and let's delve into the goddess. The first thing that I read in your book that really caught my attention was with the goddess was the triple goddess, the threefold goddess. Could you talk to us about the maiden, the mother, and the crone?
Sure. So, you know, this is a really popular model that we see in, you know, modern goddess-centered spirituality, but we have to remind ourselves that this is a fairly modern creation. The idea of maiden, mother, and crone as this overarching archetype of the great goddess is, you know, a couple centuries old at best, really dates back to a book called The White Goddess by Robert Graves. And it's, you know, it's a poetic exploration of myth, especially centered in the British Isles. We see triple figures, both masculine and feminine, in history all around the world. And some of them do kind of follow this model of maiden, mother, and crone, but the construct as we know it today is a little more recent. But that makes it no less valid, because we can learn just as well through poetry and myth as we can through fact and history. But the idea of this is that the goddess being so great, she is marked by change, just like in our own bodies. And so in early Reconstructionist movements that started to adopt this model, we sort of associated maiden, mother, and crone with the three like moon tides of the waxing, the full, and the waning moon, as well as with the biological tides in human bodies. Mm-hmm. But we do have to remember that not all bodies go through the same tides. And there are lots of different ways to be embodied. And so we can connect to those archetypes, even if not through the traditional symbols. But in exploring the connection between the threefold goddess and the mineral kingdom, I started to see some correlations between the three phases of rock and mineral genesis, what we call the rock cycle. So we can connect the maiden, which is all about newness and freshness and, you know, spontaneity and joy and beauty and unbridled sexuality, with igneous rocks, or what we call primary formation processes. These are the newly crystallized rocks and minerals that form as molten rock and its byproducts cool. With the aspect of the mother, we can associate that with metamorphic rock, when other forms of rock are subjected to heat, pressure, or combination of the two, they're transformed. And so a lot of the sort of celestial ideas of, the great mother is the queen of heaven, is embodied in what we call orogenesis, which is the process of forming mountains. And, mm-hmm. you know, this creates a wide array of metamorphic rock, including one that we all probably know and love, lapis lazuli.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the crone, we have a deep relationship with sedimentary rock, which is a product of breaking down other rocks and rearranging them. They're actually either chemically or physically broken into sediment, into sand, into silt or clay or dust. And then those things are carried short distances or long distances and stratified. They're built up in layers and then turned into stone through a process called lithification. And that allows those strata to become records of history. And the crone herself is the wisdom keeper, the storyteller, the historian of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And so by connecting to the triple goddess through the rock cycle, we can really find new ways to embody these archetypes and bring their energy into our lives.
Okay, well, as you're talking, I just thought of a question. It's probably a really stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Does a rock have a life cycle? Because you talk about it being, you know, I guess born into the earth and then maybe extracted from the earth and maybe returned. So does it have a life cycle of sorts? Not like a human life, but does it have a life cycle?
Poetically, in a way, it really does. And, you know, everyone is different. So there's not one particular model they all follow.
Mm-hmm.
So if we start with molten rock as it cools, and there are lots of different ways it can do that, crystals begin to emerge from this liquid solution. And as those crystals form, either quickly or slowly, will determine the variety of them as well as the size of them. The chemical composition of that molten rock goo will also affect those factors. And then it can stay that way, or it can change. It can be weathered and broken down by the sands of time, by the blowing of winds and the passage of water. It can be subjected to heat or pressure and transformed again. And, you know, ultimately, it's possible that these rocks can be subducted or kind of sunk below the crust and reabsorbed, liquefied again and reborn. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of poetic parallels between the progress of the human soul and the process of, you know, geologic formation.
Okay. Talk to us about the goddess and her use of stones. You can pick one or two goddesses that you have an affinity for and how they utilize the stones to not only help themselves but help humanity.
Yeah, so, you know, it's no secret that I have a really great love affair for lapis lazuli, so I think we'll start there. Lapis is this beautiful, like, deep ultramarine blue, mineral called lazurite, sprinkled with golden pyrite, swirls of white, calcite. Sometimes you'll find other minerals like diopside and tons of things we can't pronounce, so we won't try in public. But lapis lazuli more or less means heavenly stone, and so it's associated with a lot of goddesses that connect to the sky. The idea of the queen of heaven, to the stellar goddess, to the dark goddess, because, you know, the night sky is dark and mysterious. Mm-hmm. If we go to the Middle East, where most of the lapis in today's market is produced, we see a lot of goddesses whose myth cycles include the stories of lapis. So we see in Egypt goddesses like Isis, Maat, even Hathor, sometimes associated with the stone. We can also look at Inanna or Ishtar, and in the famous story of the descent of Ishtar into the underworld, she famously is seeking the soul of her recently departed love, mm-hmm. and has to make a plea to her other half, her sister, the dark goddess Ereshkigal. And Ereshkigal is sometimes called the queen of the lapis lazuli mountain or queen of the lapis lazuli palace. And Ishtar herself gets her source of magic from this beautiful necklace that she wears that's also made of lapis. And so she passes through these seven gates, and each step of the way she has to make a sacrifice, and she's literally just wearing the clothing on her back to make this journey. And so at each of the gates, she leaves a garment until finally she's at the seventh gate, ready to stand before the lapis throne and try to bargain with Ereshkigal. And so she has to leave behind her beloved lapis necklace and, you know, enter this inner sanctum, totally bare. You know, mm-hmm. this is a symbol of vulnerability. I think mm-hmm. that's one of the beauties of what lapis does. Lapis unites our heart and our mind so we can be really truthful and transparent with what's happening in our most secret inner world. And there's this really great magic that happens when we go to these innermost spaces. And mm-hmm. this stone is often associated with magic, with transformation, with healing. There's a Babylonian goddess named Sir, S-I-R, and she's the goddess of beer and of fermentation. And this was a very alchemical process to ancients. And poetically, she was thought to brew this magical elixir in a cauldron made of lapis. Mm-hmm. So if we work with this kind of stone, we connect to these kinds of goddess figures. They are the makers of magic, the healers of all the ills of humankind. We see lapis associated with Aphrodite and this Venus, goddesses of love and fertility. So we can use this stone to really help us connect to the transformational power of love. And when we recognize that this love, though in one sense fluid and ever-changing, is always present. And that's just like the divine feminine. It waxes, it wanes, but it is still there. No matter what we've done with it in a societal or historical sense, the energies are ever present. And so I think lapis, as sort of this symbol of the shaman's death and rebirth, can also help us rebirth the new current of the divine feminine in today's world.
Absolutely love it. And I've got a hunk of lapis, and part of it is polished and part of it is raw. And when people come to my office, and I always have it on the table, they are immediately drawn to it and they have to pick it up. They just can't let it sit. So I understand the draw for the lapis. But, you know, that brings up a question. When I have personal stones that I wear on a daily basis, and don't you dare touch them, because that's, to me, it's like part of my energy. And, you know, to me, it would be like me reaching out and touching you in an inappropriate place. What are your thoughts on other people handling your stones?
You know, since I sit in that role as teacher a lot, I bring my personal toolbox to workshops and classes, and I share those things pretty freely. And if something is really sacred to me or is, you know, involved in some process that's very personal, I won't take it out in public. But generally speaking, I'm pretty happy to share my stones. If we look at this through the lens of physics, people need not even be within arm's reach before their energy field is you know, in contact with the stone. And that's really where the exchange is happening, on that energetic level. You know, we produce these electromagnetic fields from our bodies that extend many, many, many feet out from the center of us. And so we just need a stone to be within our energy field in order to influence us and for us to influence the stone, which just goes to show that, you know, we can wear our favorite crystals and we can have the right frame of mind all day long, and they still need a good cleansing, because unless you're totally isolated from all other electromagnetic fields on Earth, then let's face it, if you're on Earth, that's not happening, then they need a pretty regular cleansing.
Okay, so talk to us about that regular cleansing. I mean, you talked earlier about cleansing it once we, you know, receive a stone, but what can we do on a daily or at least weekly basis to keep our stones fresh?
So one of my favorite things to do when I get home from a long day of work or teaching or travel, I have a big bowl full of chunks of Himalayan rock salt, and for anything that is safe and stable to put in contact with the salt, I just put it right there, you know, sort of strip off my gems and set them down, and they get to spend at least an hour or two, if not overnight, or several days if need be. Mm-hmm. I also have some slabs of selenite that I use for that kind of work. For stones that are water stable, you can give them a quick rinse when you get home. Ideally, alternating between warm and cool water is going to give you a better effect, because it actually will cause the crystal lattice to expand and contract in a really minute kind of way, but it's enough to kind of wring out the energies they picked up, just like wringing out a sponge. If we're using other stones to cleanse our crystals, like the salt or the selenite, we have to remember to cleanse those too. There are these really persistent myths that there are certain crystals that never need cleansing or clearing. And although we could trace those myths on air, it's not as exciting if we do. So just suffice it to say that if we're using that piece of selenite to cleanse our stones, it's like using the sponge to wash your dishes. Eventually, the sponge gets really funky.
Yeah,
and it needs a good clean too. So I think that's a really good analogy to bring the awareness there. So you know, that's where sage or sound or one of your other tools might come into play.
Okay, so what happens when you have a beautiful piece of selenite and it decides to change colors on you? It starts to turn orange.
I mean, you know, without actually seeing the specimen in question, there could be a lot of things that have happened. It may be that it has picked up oils from skin, or that certain trace elements in it have denatured from sunlight or heat or any number of other factors. But every now and then we need a crystal that just defies the laws of physics. And although I've got that mineral science background and I love to be as logical as I can, I know that there are things that, you know, physics just doesn't explain. There is still magic in the universe, and we don't have to reduce it all to data. So sometimes those things just happen.
Okay. So talk to us about the stone and or fossil amber. There's a lot of fake amber out there in the world today. So first of all, how can you identify it as being legit? What should we look for? What properties can it enhance for us?
So authentic amber is pretty easy to identify under the right circumstances with one of two different tests. The first is a saltwater float. So if you have amber that hasn't been set in jewelry, you know, it's not attached to any metal or anything else, it should float in salt water. A lot of the synthetics and mimetics that are out there will not do this. Another one that you can do, if it is set in jewelry and you can find a really unobtrusive place to make a mark on it, if you take a pin or a nail or something else that you can heat up in a candle flame very carefully without burning yourself, if you touch that to a piece of the amber, it will smell like pine resin, because that's what it is. And if it smells like burning plastic, then you have a piece of plastic
burning
on
plastic.
Your hands.
Okay.
Exactly. Now, there are also composites, so they can mix and match natural amber with synthetic amber, I personally wouldn't use those in my practice, but those are abound. And even natural amber can be heat treated and go through other processes to enhance the look of it. So, it's sometimes really hard to tell the difference. But as far as what we can do with amber, you know, on the first level, I always like to make the analogy that, amber is similar to the circulatory system and also the immune system of these ancient trees. And the trees derive their metabolic energy from sunlight. They convert that into chemical compounds that transfer energy, and then those are carried through the circulatory system. So in one way or another, when we hold that beautiful, bright, golden yellow piece of amber, it is solidified sunlight. So So in astrology, we might use the sun to represent success and sovereignty. It is an illuminating force. So amber relates to all of those things. Maybe there's a particular sun goddess you want to connect to. Amber is a great way to do that. Amber has been associated with fertility, with love, with protection because it's a mysterious substance. And, you know, amber, though very, very old and fossilized, is not a true mineral. It has no crystal structure. So since it breaks a lot of those rules of the mineral kingdom, it can kind of help us, you know, break rules as well. Other things that are not truly minerals might include opal and obsidian, tektites such as Libyan desert glass or moldavite or indochinite, other natural glasses like fulgurite. So these things don't have a real crystal structure. They might have what we call short-range order. If we zoom in on a few molecules, they resemble crystal, but when we zoom out, those don't connect to anything. They don't form a crystal lattice, that repeating structure that defines crystallinity. So when we encounter a substance that isn't truly crystalline, it allows to go into that sort of wellspring of creation, the cauldron of chaos out of which all things are born. So there's this great potential in working with a stone or an organic material like amber that allows us to go into this sort of primordial state where we can feel empowered to create whatever we want to in our lives.
Okay. So if you're out there and you're looking for gemstones and, you know, you're looking for it in a form of jewelry, say you have, let's pick, I did amber, amethyst. So let's say amethyst. Should it be encased in a certain metal, like gold or silver? Does it really make a difference?
There are so many schools of thought on this. One particular form of crystal therapy that I practice is called gemstone therapy or gemstone energy medicine. It has really specific requirements for gem quality and even the shapes of them. We prefer to use gemstone spheres. And in that school of using stones, they think that metals can be detrimental. And if we look at a very ancient form of working with crystals that is still in practice today, Ayurvedic gem therapy, actually marries specific metals and specific stones according to your astrological chart and the current astrological transit. They'll even go so far as to look at the influences that are happening astrologically and tell you how big of a stone, how much of it you need in your life to create the change that you're looking for. So I think it just goes to show that there are so many different perspectives on this. So we get to feel out the ones that work for us. You know, if we really wanted to work with a stone like amethyst, which is, you know, derives its name from the Greek amethystine, which means not intoxicated, which is a reference to a story about a nymph by name of Amethyst who is transformed into stone to escape Bacchus or Dionysus by the work of the lunar goddess, the hunt goddess, Diana Artemis. You know, she's associated with the moon and with amethyst, and silver is associated with the moon as well, so you might want that to be enhanced by that lunar property by setting it in silver. But, you know, ultimately, feel it out. Find the right tool for you. There are so many things that different metals can bring to the table. So it's perfectly okay to get a gemstone set in whatever metal works for you.
Okay. Now, the one thing that surprised me in your book was that you included copper as a stone. And then as I was reading more, I understood that copper went through various stones, like copper or through the malachite, and you talked about the lapis and all. But why did you include copper as a standalone entity for description in your book?
Well, first and foremost, because copper is a native mineral. It forms sometimes discrete crystals. It is mined in ores. It is a geologic substance. So many of our metals that do come as sort of standalone substances in nature are truly minerals. It includes gold and silver, lead, and several others. But even when they're not standalone minerals, they're found in ore minerals that, you know, might be, in the case of copper, something along the lines of covellite or chalcopyrite or bornite or any number of other copper ores. And the reason it's in this book is because it has this deep relationship with the divine feminine. The word copper traces back to the Greek name for the island of Cyprus, which is Kupros. And this was where the world's ancient copper mines were located, the real first stores of copper that were commercially mined and available to, you know, pre-modern societies. And in this particular island in the Mediterranean is where the worship of Aphrodite or Venus came to be. And if we look at the name of Aphrodite, it means foam born, you know, carried by the waves. And she was this goddess who emerged from the primordial ocean, and the place where she set foot is on the island of Cyprus. It's the very first place she made landfall, if you will. And that happens to be where ancient copper was mined. Astrologically speaking, through the lens of modern astrology and even ancient astrology and alchemy, we see that there are planetary metals, specific metals associated with each of the planets. And naturally, the planetary metal of Venus is copper. And this profound relationship between the divine feminine with the particular cult of Aphrodite or Venus and with copper itself. And, you know, copper has embodied this in so many different ways. And in the mineral kingdom, when we see copper in specific minerals, they often relate to the heart center and to our emotional well-being. And this is all, you know, under the domain of Lady Venus herself. One of the other ways that it shows up is in the way that copper reacts chemically. And the medieval alchemists had this really special title for copper. They used to call her Meretrix Metallorum, which in Latin means the harlot of metal. Maybe not the politest of title, but you know, Lady Copper is so willing to join with other substances. They were making kind of a veiled joke here and saying that copper was easy. You know, she pleases everybody, but by joining with these other substances, metals and non-metals alike, she transforms them. She's, you know, willing, ready, she's able to join with sulfides and carbonates and silicates and just so many other beautiful chemical elements and bases out there that we get such a wide variety of copper minerals that result. So, you know, copper is transformational. One of my colleagues actually calls copper the eternal synergist because of this ability it has to link, to transform, and to make things greater than just the sum of their parts. And if that isn't a representation of the divine feminine, then I don't know what is.
What is, exactly, what is. Okay, so on the subject of harlots, in your book you talk about the sacred harlot, the different goddesses described as temple whores. Tell us about that.
You know, there's this expression that the gods of the old religion become the demons of the new, and when patriarchy and patriarchal religion rose to the fore, you know, thousands of years ago, and power began to shift, the easiest way to convince people not to worship the great goddess was to say that it was a bad thing to do. And so women's bodies were denigrated and downplayed. Sexuality was something that was considered profane rather than sacred. And, you know, sex is as natural as breathing. We literally need it to sustain our race. Otherwise, you know, we stop doing that, we stop having human beings. And so to the great goddess, these were all acts of worship, all acts of connecting to what is greater than ourselves. And so we had this sort of shift from sacred harlots and, you know, sacred goddesses who embodied passion and fertility and sexuality, as well as gods who did the same, to really trying to downplay these. And so, you know, the cults of these ancient deities were given a really bad smear in the press of the days, you could say. And so we see expressions like temple whores and temple prostitutes, even in the Bible. And they're really references to the worship of the ancient goddess. And I think one of the great things that we can do as human beings of any gender is to claim sexuality as sacred again, to, you know, maybe not put it out in public if we're not called to and it's not appropriate to, but to allow that to be a sacred process of living and breathing and being a part of the changing face of our world. There's an expression that's common in you know, traditions of Wicca and other forms of witchcraft, that all acts of love and pleasure are her ritual, implying, you know, the rituals of the Great Mother. So anything that we do, you know, in a consensual and appropriate way is an act of worship of the goddess. And so there are specific goddesses that have kind of embodied this archetype throughout the ages. One of my favorites to connect to is one that's honored in the Thelemic traditions and in Enochian magic called Babylon. And more than likely, this is sort of the secret guise of Inanna or Ishtar, although she's sometimes associated with other goddesses throughout history. One of her epithets is the Scarlet Woman. And so in the book, you're going to see the Scarlet Temple Lemurian Seed Crystals, also called Strawberry Lemurian Seed Crystals, that really embody her energy and several copper minerals, not just copper itself, but also cuprite, the chief ore of copper, which is the copper oxide, is really great for embodying that principle of the sacred harlot and allowing us to honor sexuality on all parts of the spectrum again.
Okay. Now, we talked a little bit about the harlots, but let's talk about the mistress of magic. And who is or what is the mistress of magic? I'll get that out. And then I want to talk to how we can incorporate some spells, if you will, to make our lives better utilizing goddess energy and stone energy.
When I wrote the book, I was really trying to look at ways that I could categorize crystals and the goddesses that they relate to. So I had to kind of comb through the themes that we see that recur through the many goddesses and find discrete ways to group them. And of course, when we look at gods and deities and spirits as archetypes, that's not all they are. And it's real hard to reduce anyone to just a single thing. Like, you know, I'm Nicholas, but I'm not just a writer. I'm not just a Reiki practitioner. I'm not just a musician. I'm more than that. It's the same with our goddesses. But the archetype that I refer to as the mistress of magic is, you know, the fairy queen, the one who is the ruler of that sort of other world. She is the bringer of magic and transformation into the world. She is the initiator of the mysteries. And so we might see her pop up as goddesses like Caridwen or as Ishtar, as Isis. You know, we'll see her in lots of other traditions as well. And when we work with the mistress of magic, she can be the one who opens the door, parts the veil to mystery. And this is an ineffable thing. We can't put it into words. We try. We can turn it into art. We could maybe interpret it through music or dance, but still it is a glimpse of the profound mystery that's underneath it all. So if we wanted to connect to this archetype of specific stones, you know, lapis would be a great one. Lapis, you know, visually represents the expanse of the night sky, the eternity of the cosmos, and that's a great way to connect. But you might also choose something like maybe moonstone, which is traditionally associated with magic and with the Great Mother as well. So there's so many different stones that you can use to kind of sort through these archetypes, and ultimately it's up to us to make personal relationships with them and use them as stepping stones to get to know the goddesses that we choose to work with.
Okay, so kind of like bottom line, if you're really not that familiar with the process of using stones and cleansing them and whatever, if you found a stone that you really liked, okay, and you brought it home and you knew enough to cleanse it and possibly program it to the best of your ability, is that enough to and just let that stone's energy integrate with your energy so that you can move forward with life?
It's definitely a start. Think of the relationship we have with stones just like the relationships we have with people. We meet a new person, we get to know them, we take them out for coffee, we start to form a bond there. But then if we never call or text or do anything else with them, how deep is that friendship going to be? You know, same thing, you know, if we just tuck a stone absentmindedly into our pocket or place it under the pillow at night, there's something happening. But how conscious are we of that process? One of my teachers, Naisha Azian, she loves to say that taking a crystal to bed is no better way of getting to know it than taking a human being to bed. You know, you might have some great, meaningful fun overnight, but how well did we really get to know that experience?
Right.
And so the more consciously we co-create with our stones, the better off we're going to be. If there's nothing else you do, just make some quiet time in your life and sit down with your stones. You might call it meditation. You might just call it reflection or contemplation. You know, you can keep a journal of the impressions that arise. You can go through specific visualizations. You can engage them in ritual and magic and spellcraft. You can do whatever works for you, just as long as you're forging an intentional relationship with them.
Okay. And a bit of that spells or magic that I was talking about, a lot of people are calling me today. They're so stressed out, and everybody thinks that they're possessed and, you know, 99.99999% or not. In your book, you talk about different spells, and I think there was even an exorcism bundle in your book. Could you give some general information, because I want people to go get the book, but can you give some general information on how people can create something like this to help them, help their energy field as they are traversing the universe?
Yeah, so, you know, spellcraft and ritual is personal. There are specific traditions that are out there. So when I wrote the ones that are here in the book and I experimented, I wanted to make them as universal and requiring as simple of an ingredient as we can all generally find in our local metaphysical store or easily get online. So nothing in here is going to be super complex. But, you know, we can make crystal elixirs, we can make charm bags and pouches and bundles like the exorcism bundle, or there's also a wealth pouch and a cleansing charm bag in there, one for a happy home. You can make crystal grids and turn those into conscious spells. Mm-hmm. The simplest form of any sort of ritual or magic has to start with an intent. So we have to really clarify what is our mission here. And ideally, this should come from the perspective of the higher self, of the soul, of your holy guardian angel, your true will, as we might call it in occultism, not just your day-to-day, oh, what do I think I want, what do I think I need, although those can be a part of the process too. There's nothing less spiritual about wanting a better car. There's mm-hmm. nothing that makes you less profound of a practitioner because you want to excel at your job, because those things are part of your spiritual path, because everything you're doing is part of your spiritual path. Mm-hmm. You are spirit incarnate. Mm-hmm. So once we've got our clarity of intent, then we also need to have, the raw fuel, the strength of will. So intention is our navigation system. It's the steering wheel. Our willpower is something that we develop maybe through meditation or through practice. And that's going to be the fuel for it. And then we need a vehicle. You know, there's got to be something we put it all in. So that might be a spoken incantation. It might be a visualization. It might be an affirmation you repeat out loud. It might also be programming a crystal or making a crystal grid or tying things together into a little pouch that you'll take with you. Mm-hmm. So when we combine these three core elements, that's when we make magic happen. And these are things that we find in traditions around the world. And they're open-ended enough to allow you room to experiment. So when you look at the spellcraft and the ritual and everything that's in the book, treat those like you would a recipe book. You know, if you're not a big fan of onions, you might leave them out of a recipe or substitute them for something else. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with the spellcraft. Maybe there's a particular ingredient you don't have an affinity for, or you just don't have it. So make a substitution within reason. You know, if you're working on love magic and you don't have rose petals, you probably would want to pick something else that represents love to you, mm-hmm. or at least traditionally represents love, so that way we're staying within the energetic parameters. But still, that's the beautiful thing about making magic, about healing, about the spiritual arts. They're just that. They're an art form, so we get to take creative license with them.
So it sounds to me like you're saying, you know, do the best you can, but pay attention to your intuition and incorporate that along the way.
Totally.
Okay. So when we go to your website, theluminouspearl.com, what are we going to find there?
You'll find some brief information about me, the things that I've written. You'll find a contact form, some information about my Reiki classes. There's also going to be an opportunity to reach out if you're interested in a consultation with crystal or gemstone medicine. If there's a particular stone you're looking for, or if there's a particular situation in your life that you're trying to problem solve and you think crystals might be the answer, I'm happy to provide some guidance for you. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some details about that on the website as well, and links to many interviews that I've done and articles that I've written. So this will end up on the website too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of information there, folks, so you can immerse yourself in some wonderful energy. And just like the name of his website, The Luminous Pearl, once you get in there and you spend a moment or two there, you feel your aura just like bounce and lighten up. So it's a great, great, great feeling. Nicholas, what words of wisdom or pearls of wisdom, should I say, that you would like to leave with the audience today?
You know, we live in such a fast-paced world that is changing. And I think by connecting to the mineral kingdom, we learn to slow things down and be more present. And that mm-hmm. allows us to be more conscious witnesses to the changes we want to see happening in the world. So I really hope you'll take the time to slow down, connect to your favorite stones, and maybe hear the voice of the goddess speaking through them to help you with both personal and planetary transformation.
Okay. Well, thank you to Nicholas and to the audience for being with me tonight as we collectively get over it and embrace stones of the goddess. I'm truly honored and I appreciate your time and attention. And when you're ready to raise your vibration and shift your energy, give me a call. Intuitive consultations 30 minutes or longer are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make that call, 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of embracing stones and goddesses. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.